What do you know about dancing? Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that likes to throw a sun lounger into the swimming pool of life. Now, David Winters has had one of the most unusual movie careers we've come across at Exploding Helicopter HQ. He made his name back in the 50s as a Broadway dancer, appearing in both the stage and film adaptations of West Side Story. Later, he became an actor and choreographer on Hollywood films such as A Star Is Born and Elvis Presley's Viva Las Vegas. Then, in the 1980s, his career took a very unusual turn when he founded his own film company and started producing and directing low-budget action films for the home video market, including cult classics like Deadly Prey and Space Mutiny. The film we're looking at on this show, though, is the last film Winters ever made. It saw the movie mogul return to his show business roots by making a romantic musical about teenagers who just love to dance. And weirdly, it also includes an exploding helicopter. So on this show, we're looking at Dancing It's On. To help me review the film, my guest might be starting this podcast as a rookie kid from the chorus line, but I know he's going to come back a star. It's the DTV connoisseur himself, Matt Poirier. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Thank you, Will. And I'm still laughing a little bit from throwing the patio furniture of life into the swimming pool.
We definitely need to talk about that moment in the film, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But it's great to have you to back on. You were only on a couple of episodes ago when we were doing a deep dive into Jim Belushi, and you gave us a bit of an inside glimpse into your PhD thesis, representations of American masculinity in the 21st century, the cinema of James Belushi.
Yes, titled the Doughy White Guy, right? The Doughy White Guy Dad of America.
Exactly. I look forward to you completing your work on that. Yes, in terms of the film we're reviewing today, I really felt like the stars aligned on this one, because weirdly, in a strange quirk of fate, we pretty much watched this film at the same time, independently of each other. And it's a very strange film. And I felt that I just had to seize the moment to podcast about it, because it's not often either, you know, I talk about romantic musicals on the Exploding Helicopter podcast, and certainly it's a genre that you don't tend to cover a lot over at DTV Connoisseur.
No, I mean, this one, the reason why I wanted to watch this is it was a quirk in Gary Daniels' career, who, you know, put a lot of his movies, and it just happened to be available for free here in the U.S. now. And the funny thing is, I don't know if other people who listen to your podcast do this, but the moment I see an exploding helicopter in a movie like this, something like this, it's offbeat. It's like, oh, I've got to go to your letterbox list and see if you know that this is has an exploding helicopter in it. And sure enough, it was there. I was going to say, because then it's like I had to tweet you about it to see, like, yeah, you know, I think the joke was that there's a mime in this film, too. Was it the only exploding helicopter with a mime in it? And you mentioned A View to a Kill, so.
Yes, I need to double check whether there is the presence of a mime artist in that film. I've got a kind of hazy recollection that there might be. But certainly, if you were to draw a Venn diagram of films with exploding helicopters and films with mime artists, there wouldn't be much of an overlap between the two. But as I mentioned in the introduction here, David Winters is pretty much the creative force behind this film. And, you know, Winters is an interesting character because in the 80s, after this long career, sort of primarily as a choreographer and dancer, in the 80s, he then moved into producing movies. And together with David Pryor and Peter Duvall, he founded Action International Pictures. And over the next 15 years, that company produced and distributed around 60 films, mostly thrillers and action films. And, you know, Matt, I know that you've covered the work of AIP on your site. So I wondered, what place do you think Winters and the work of AIP holds in that sort of 80s, 90s era of direct-to-video output?
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing one, because it's like, so you've got Canon, right? Everybody knows Canon. That's kind of the big one. And that's where your big names are, your Stallone and Michael Dudikoff and, you know, Robert Ginty. And then maybe like the next tier, kind of as you get out of the 80s and get into the 90s, you've got PM Entertainment, and they almost sort of take over the mantle. At the same time, AIP is like this tier. I don't know how many tiers down you'd say it is, Some of the films feel like they could be like made in the Philippines in the 80s at that same time, and you know, Italian directors. But it's a very fascinating thing, and you do see names in their movies from time to time, like Robert Zadar, which I'm hoping for listeners to your podcast that's a name for them. I don't know if Robert Zadar is necessarily a name, you know. And of course, Reb Brown, we know, Space Mutiny was one of theirs. That's probably like the most famous in the sense that it it was on MST3K. I am myself just sort of finally getting into their films and trying to watch more of them because they were a very unique piece of the 80s DTV scene. There's a sense of danger when you watch the movies, not in the sense of like the movies themselves have action and danger, but the sense of like, wow, they're using real explosives here. I wonder if anybody's going to get hurt. You know, like, we want to be careful with this. David Pryor, he wrote and directed a lot of these movies and working with Winters, and his brother Ted stars in them, probably the most famous being Deadly Prey. So I think those are probably the two big ones people know. Deadly Prey, just because that one is just so over the top, wacky. I also had Cameron Mitchell in it, who was in Space Mutiny, so he's another mainstay of AIP films. It's one that I recommend people, if you're into, you know, if you've gotten through Canon, you've gotten through PM Entertainment, AIP is the next place to go.
Yeah, I think why perhaps sort of AIP are like maybe a couple of tiers down, you know, from, I think it's interesting, as you said, to compare them to companies like PM Entertainment and Canon. I think AIP are definitely like several tiers down from there, in just in terms of like the budgets that were clearly they were able to get together for these films, because you don't have the stars in these films of AIP that you do in, say, the way that you get maybe in, like, you know, PM Entertainment, where, you know, you'll have like a Gary Daniels, you know, heading up that film. You don't get those types of figures. You get these sort of, I don't know where you would want to put them, third or fourth tier, you know, people like Reb Brown, people like that, who are the stars of these particular films. But you do get you know, famous faces cropping up in them. And I think you know, Robert Davey seemed to have some sort of tie-in deal, because he there's a sort of phase in the mid-90s where he's cropping up in a lot of these films. So you do get to see some, you know, recognizable names here, you know, if you're not sort of familiar with the kind of this tier of DTV action.
Yeah, there was one that was made in the 90s that had Pamela Anderson, and it had
Robert Hayes
and David Keith. No, Keith. Is it David Keith or
it's
Keith?
It's very
David?
Confusing.
Right, exactly. One of the two. Not the one with the great voice that does a lot of voice work here in the United States, and it was in Chronicles of Riddick, the other one. But yeah, and I think there was a huge lawsuit involved with that, because Pamela Anderson had signed on to do that picture, and then so word on the street is she got barbed wire offered to her, and suddenly came up with this idea that Robert Hayes and David Keith treated her very roughly in the love scenes in the film, and you know, she wanted to get out of her the deal to do the film. Word on the street is that maybe it was more the fact that she wanted to do barbed wire and she didn't want to do an AIP film. But that one, I believe, is available on YouTube if people want to check out. So yeah, as they got kind of into the 90s, I mean, PM did the same thing. As they got into the 90s, they started to get bigger names, like, you know, and instead of Pamela Anderson, they got Anna Nicole Smith to head their films, or a couple of their films. So yeah, it is interesting to see the progression, because yeah, I mean, if you watch those 80s AIP ones, it's like they built, and I think Ted Pryor, their star, helped build these. I think he was like a set designer. They built this like corrugated iron shanty town like village out in the woods, and they would use that for all manner of things, like numerous drug dealers had their bases there, you know, heroes were tortured there, you know, all kinds of stuff happened there. I think there's a few films that use that little shanty town area, so they made good use of multiple sets and shots and things like that over numerous films.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that shanty town on a regular basis as I make my way through the AIP canon. But I think it's time we got stuck into Dancing It's On, so cue the trailer.
Who's the new girl you're with?
That's the boss's daughter.
Can she dance?
My only chance to be something is through my dancing. It's my life.
It's the same as me.
You show me. Let's go.
Yeah. These last couple days, it's been like you weren't even here. It's hard, isn't it?
I'm counting on you to keep my daughter away from that kid.
I saw you dancing with the boss's daughter. In what world will you get a girl like that?
I will not have you dating some dishwasher.
I don't need you to make those decisions for me.
If you love her, you have to go get her.
You can play baseball, but you can't play dance.
Dance comes from the heart.
Welcome to the Florida Statewide Dance Contest Finals.
Go and do what you were born to do.
Teenage high school student Jennifer is sent to spend the summer with her estranged father at the hotel he runs in Florida. Whilst there, she falls in love with Ken, an aspiring dancer who's working as a dishwasher on the hotel's staff. Naturally, the path of young love does not run smooth. Believing she deserves better, Jennifer's father tries to sabotage the relationship between Ken and his daughter, and further complications ensue when we discover that Ken's current dance partner is nursing an unrequited love for him. All this plays out against the backdrop of a big dance competition that Ken sees as his ticket to stardom. Unfortunately, Ken can't nail the killer choreography that would win him the title. If only the reclusive old man who lives at the hotel turned out to be a former dance champion. Will Ken and Jen get together? Will they team up in time to win the dance competition? The tension is palpable. Heading up the cast here are Dancing with the Stars winner Whitney Carson and a gentleman who won So You Think You Can Dance. I'm going to give his name an attempt here. Chihon Wasepi Tshop. That's as good as it's going to get from me. Aside from them, the only recognisable acting talent on display is British beat-em-up star and DTV legend Gary Daniels, who's playing Jennifer's dad, and David Winters, who, not content with directing, writing and producing the film, plays the role of Hal, the mysterious old man and dance guru. Now, Dancing It's On was released theatrically, but as far as I can see, only made $27,000 at the box office. It's not a well-regarded film and has just a 2.7 rating on IMDb, making it one of the worst-reviewed films we've tackled on the podcast. But as I always like to say, to hell with everyone else's opinion. Matt, what did you make of Dancing It's On?
I tried to go into this with this idea of, like, I'm not a dance film fan. So, yes, it's not going to be for me. But I thought, like, you know what? If, you know, the fact that they had dance routines every, like, 10 to 15 minutes, I tried to put that my own mindset of, like, if I watch a PM flick or something like that or any action movie, I want an action sequence every 10 to 15 minutes. By the same token, these dance sequences, yes, they look like they were very well done. Like, there's a lot of talent with the dancers involved. And I think some of them looked good too. I think they were well done. But then, like, we talked about the joke, you know, the angry dance sequence where you're throwing patio furniture into the pool. Like, I mean, I don't think that has ever been pulled off well. I don't know that, you know, the angry dance. I mean, I remember when Kevin Bacon did the angry dance sequence in Footloose, you know, and he's like jumping around and everything. I think a Family Guy made lampooned that in an episode. So, I mean, that one never works. You also have the traditional, like, oh, the white blonde female lead just happens to be in a Latin part of town, and now she's doing Latin dances with the locals. You know, it's one of those things that was cringy in the 80s and 90s when we'd see it, and now in 2015 we're watching it and it's like, are we still doing this? Like, is this still kind of a thing? It's like, so there was that. And then, of course, the story itself. And again, I try to say, because my rule with action films is that who cares about the plot if the action's there? But this plot had some really major holes with it. And I don't know what was going on. There's still this fetishism here in the U.S. with Romeo and Juliet that, for some reason, I guess maybe most Americans, because, you know, to be fair, about most of my fellow Americans, when we are assigned something like Romeo and Juliet in school, we just do the cliff notes and probably don't know what the ending of Romeo and Juliet is. So everybody thinks it's this beautiful love story thing and forget the fact that, you know, and spoiler alert to people that watch this movie, the two main characters don't die at the end. They don't kill themselves.
I love how you're concerned about spoilers for a 500-year-old play.
Right, exactly. Well, no, I'm talking about for this movie that they were trying to do Romeo and Juliet, but they didn't kill the main characters off. So, that whole story thing, there was just a mess. There's a lot of things going on there that hurt it. And so, you know, I was trying to be fair to it by saying I don't know dance movies, and I mean, you know, American in Paris is one that I've always liked, and of course, Singing in the Rain. But beyond that, my knowledge is kind of that's about the extent of it. And there were some really good dance sequences, and I think for my novice understanding of it. But again, there's the cliche ones that just didn't work. And I think the story, I think it could have used more than one rewrite, perhaps. I think this is one that David Pryor, I think, actually helped David Winters on. And so knowing how David Pryor wrote scripts in his movies, and again, there's a kind of a kitsch factor to those old 80s AIP films that you can forgive the plot holes, where this didn't quite have that.
Well, yeah, I think you mentioned some interesting points there. I think I definitely had some issues with the plot, because I think there are a few threads that sort of didn't really go anywhere. You know, some of the relationships with the characters, the relationship between Jennifer and her dad, you know, it's at the beginning of the film, it's set up that they are meant to be estranged from each other, and she's being forced to sort of spend the summer with him at this hotel. And, you know, you kind of thought, okay, there's going to be some sort of rapprochement between the two. But the film actually doesn't really sort of sort that particular sort of dynamic out at any particular point. It just kind of, like, I don't know, loses interest, or people just moved on to other things. So, yeah, there's some definite issues with the plot here, but... I don't know. This is an objectively terrible film. The script is bad. As I mentioned, the plot threads are, some of them just don't go anywhere. I think the acting is generally poor here. Yet weirdly, I don't dislike this movie. I must be getting very sentimental in my old age. I think it's because there's a sort of purity of intent here, which I think is quite sweet. And that there's a sort of lack of cynicism, and I kind of respect the intent behind it. I mean, David Winters had basically kind of stopped making movies at the sort of turn of the 2000s, and he sort of out of nowhere, he sort of like decided to put this film together. And I you know, he was getting old, he was in his mid-70s, and you sort of think, this must have been, you know, I've got one last shot to make a film going back to my roots that's all about dancing. I kind of come at the film from that perspective of, you know, this is a man in the twilight of his years just wanting to kind of do one last thing in the dance world. And that kind of makes me view this film quite charitably, despite its many, many flaws.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. The earnestness comes through, I think, throughout the film, that this is something that this was a passion piece for David Winters. And actually mentioning that part, that it was kind of coming towards the end of his life, that maybe he needed to rush it, right? And so he didn't maybe have the time to cover up some of those plot holes in it. But I think it's refreshing in this sort of this churn and burn world that we're in with the DTV ecosystem. You know, my recent podcast, we're talking about Bruce Willis movies, where they're just sort of like, get, you know, slap his name on the, in his face on the tin, and just, you know, pump this thing out and hope it gets some streams. And so in light of that, I definitely agree there. I think that was one area that was one thing that made me want to not be so harsh on it, you know, and not, you know, be like, you know, it, like you said, like, you know, the acting leaves something to be desired. I think, you know, part of that is a lot of them are dancers. And the fact that the dance numbers themselves turned out as well as they did, based on the fact that this does feel like it was maybe a rush job, I think is testament to it. But I agree with that there, that the sort of the fact that this does have, this is a bit of a passion piece for David Winters, and it does feel like, you know, something that he really wanted to do or loved to do. I think especially in the current DTV environment, it definitely, like I said, it made me want to be a little bit softer on it for sure.
We've both mentioned the acting in this film, and you mentioned that, yeah, I think the issue probably comes from the fact that they are dancers, and I think that's definitely the issue. I was looking up like the characters here to see what else they've done, and basically they haven't really done anything since. So I think, yeah, just acting is not something that they were sort of trained in or have much experience in. I think the other thing that really hinders the performances in this film, which is I think a really noteworthy point, is the fact that all of the dialogue in this film has clearly been added in post, been like overdubbed later. So for whatever reason, they weren't recording sound live on the sets or the locations where they were recording. And because it's all been sort of dubbed in later, I don't know what you felt, but it kind of created an air of unreality to the film, because its intonations are slightly off or don't quite match with people's expressions in the scenes and things. And it just created this sort of unreality, this otherworldly sort of quality to the film, which works in its favor, because obviously you're thinking, this is, you know, I mean, it's not helpful to the performances or anything, but it's strangely hypnotic, because you're just thinking, this is so strange, and it really helps keep your attention through some of the rougher moments in this film.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And again, you know, coming back to the point that a lot of the cast weren't actors, I think the idea that they then have to go through and overdub their lines or, you know, say them, you know, sort of out of context like that or not in the in the moment makes it even harder for them. Yeah, there was a lot going on in this movie that I think had that quality to it. There were a lot of things that were happening where you're just like, I mean, the main character, Ken, he's a dishwasher. Now, I've done my time in kitchens as a dishwasher myself, so I kind of know how it works. And I don't know if you caught this, but it seems like he always had to go back and wash dishes. Like, he'd just be in the middle of something and like, oh, I've got to go finish my – like, that's not how dishwashing works. You don't just, like, leave your shift and then come back and do the dishes later. Like, the dishes are there the entire time. You've got to deal with the rush or whatever. That seemed – it seemed like it just things like that that would happen. And like you said, the overdubbing, like when they would argue, when Ken and Jennifer had their spat and – split up, it was hard to understand that they didn't like each other or that they were splitting up because the conversation just seems so not like what two people who were upset with each other would
no,
have.
No, definitely. I mean, talking of the two main characters, you know, that's Ken and Jennifer here. I kind of found their story arcs, if I'm honest, a bit boring. You know, it's very predictable. There's an initial attraction, then there's a bump in the road, and they sort of think, oh, like, you know, they give up on each other, but then they're drawn back together at the end. I mean, it's all sort of very predictable stuff, cliched stuff that you've seen many, many times before. But the character I found myself most drawn to, oddly, was the character of Danny, who is this third wheel in their relationship. He's this character that Jennifer's dad is intent on setting up with his daughter, because he's appalled at the thought of his daughter getting together with a dishwasher on his staff. But I don't know what you felt, Matt, but in many ways he came across like a psychopath to me. I don't know if you picked up that vibe for him as well.
Yes, I think the problem was, again, I think because I a lot of times when I'm on my blog and I'm reviewing a movie, if I don't like it, I try to be like solutions oriented, like what would have made this movie better. And I felt like this whole like shoehorn thing where Gary Daniels wanted Danny to be the boyfriend for Jennifer. And so then, of course, like he gets this idea that the dad wants him in, which I guess if you want to do the psychopath thing, it actually kind of makes sense in that sense, in that way, because if Danny really was a psychopath, he'd be grooming the dad to right to get in with Jennifer. So that makes sense. But I thought a better storyline would have been that, like, the tension is from the dad saying, you can't be with Ken. Ken's a dishwasher. I'm a rich hotel mogul. You can't be with the dishwasher. And that causes the tension in the relationship. While Danny is off with the other woman that was originally Ken's partner from the whole start. Like, they're just the dance team that's like the best and they're always really good. And maybe Danny's a jerk, but he's like a really good dancer and there's no relationship piece of it. And that also might have helped too with the fact that in the movie, you know, Hal ends up showing Ken and Jennifer how to dance and kind of almost gives them an edge that they, you know, made it kind of, I don't know, it made it weird. But I think it would have made for better tension. It also would have gotten like the relationship piece that you were talking about with Gary Daniels more involved, because I think that hinders the relationship with Jennifer and Gary Daniels, because this Danny piece is just so weird, right? Like, you know, you've got to date this Danny guy, which, and again, maybe I'm wrong about this, but like, how much further up is manager of bellhop, right? Like Ben Bellhop versus dishwasher, like, you know, and if he moved his way up, if the idea is he's going to move his way up, how could Ken the dishwasher not be moving his way up? So yeah, there were a lot of pieces like that, but I you know, Danny, the other thing too is that Danny has quite this heel turn at the end when it's sort of resolved that he's not going to be with Jennifer, so he takes Ken's dance partner and they go and do their set and they have a really great dance routine, and in a way they're almost the underdogs because they don't have the famous choreographer in Hal showing them their dance routines. And Danny's kind of like, you know, Mr. Win at all costs guys is like, no, you know what, they deserve to win, they're the better ones. So yeah, he it's weird there. It's a strange thing that happens there. And I think again it might just come back to the fact that, you know, he's a professionally trained dancer and they're like, yeah, we want you to be this poorly developed psychopath.
Well, I don't think that he was meant to be a psychopath, but that just seemed to be the sort of the way his character came across, because he's forcing himself on Jennifer at the behest of his boss and her father. And, you know, they go out on these painful dates and his behavior is I guess what we would now be calling sort of gaslighting, you know, because, you know, Jennifer's sitting very unenthusiastically at dinner And Danny says, well, at least you could try and enjoy yourself. And, he then just sort of, he seems to sort of enjoy quite torturing Ken as well in this film by saying, oh, I'm going out to dinner with her. And then he just invites himself to breakfast there's that ridiculous scene in the limousine at the end of that really awkward dinner date where Jennifer's just said, look, I'm only here because my dad's asked me to be here, and what does Danny do? He moves in for a kiss, like for a snog. And it's just like, why are we watching this? Like, come on Danny, read the room, man.
Yeah, the whole part of it that like the dad, who's like this idea that she's estranged from her father. So she's coming to stay from the summer. And his first thing is, you've got to date this head bellhop guy because I think he's a better match for you. And also, too, the fact that the head bellhop was somehow like, he was like the lord and manor of, it was like kind of like the, I don't know what that would be, like the bailiff or something. When you think of like old, like medieval period where you've got the king who's like, and then he was like kind of under, like how that position got to be so powerful that like he could, bother Ken when Ken's in the kitchen. Like there should be a chef or someone there that's his boss, not the head bellhop telling him he needs to go back and wash dishes. And of course the fact that the head bellhop also just happens to be a really great dancer on top of the dishwasher and whoever else was working there.
Well, that's one thing we should probably talk about is the hotel where all of this film takes place. And it's a very eccentric hotel. So Jennifer arrives there, and there are, in the reception area of the hotel, there are like lots of sort of circus performers. There are acrobats. There's stilt walkers. There's someone on a tricycle. The receptionist is quoting, Shakespeare. And there are kind of people, dressed up, standing around as like Marilyn Monroe, like famous film characters. And then you meet Gary Daniels, who is, running this hotel. And there is no, you sort of think, it's very hard to match Gary Daniels as the owner and, like, the manager of this particular hotel, because it's so, like, stylized. But, Gary Daniels is not giving off the vibe of anyone who would run a sort of, eccentrically themed hotel like this.
Yeah, and also the fact that there's, he's estranged from his daughter because it seems like he's too much of a stuffed shirt and all he cares about is work and all of this stuff. And so that's why I also didn't understand either what the situation was with the mom. Like, were they married but living separately because he had to run this hotel, or I couldn't remember if they'd actually been divorced. So I couldn't figure that part out either, but it's like, the whole idea was he was supposed to be using this, nice, fun hotel as a way to bring her over because she liked dancing. She liked doing all that stuff. And so he thought it would allow him to endear himself to her. And maybe that's something they should have fleshed out a little bit more, that like maybe he's the stuffed shirt guy who buys the hotel and, as a way to maybe make her happy or something. But you're right. That was something that was never, like, it didn't seem like the kind of hotel that he would be running on his own, that he would be Mr. Overseer, making sure everybody's dancing all over the place.
It was very bizarre, indeed. But we're kind of starting to talk about Gary Daniels here. So I think we should probably spend a little bit more time on the great man himself, because he's a big figure over on your website. He's an actor that you've covered. Well, he's one of the actors you've covered the most. I think only Dolph Lundgren. You've only reviewed more films by him than I think he's the only other person where you've reviewed more films by him than Gary Daniels. But as you've mentioned, that's the reason why you were watching this film. And it's a very odd one for him to be in. So yeah, what did you make of Gary Daniels in Dancing It's On?
Yeah, it's funny. If you look at this period of his filmography, in 2016, he does a David DeCoto directed Lifetime TV movie, The Wrong Child, which is like, it's got Vivica A. Fox, it's sort of a thriller. So in the 2 year span, he does these two movies here. He also does a film called Farewell Berlin Wall, which is like, I've never seen that one before. It's like, a Vietnamese German production, and I don't know what happens there. I don't know how to get a hold of it or anything. So he's starting to sort of diversify, and I don't know if that's because he wasn't getting the roles he wanted to. I know there was a period where he had to kind of slip into doing more films shot in Thailand. He had to even do like religious films. I don't know that he's actually religious like that, that he's like a in terms of like Christian faith, at least. I think he's more like Buddhist. I don't know what happened with this. If this came up for him and he was just like, I need this. I like the idea of doing something different. The thing is, there isn't much different going on here because there's just not, there isn't a lot for him, period. Other than the fact that he's hitting a punching bag at one point. There really isn't anything that's very Gary Daniels about this, you know, and it would have been interesting to see more Gary Daniels doing that. Like, again, if they had fleshed out his character more where he was doing more of a, you know, he was playing more of a part, keeping Ken and Jen apart, and this other guy, Danny, was off to the side doing whatever he was doing, then maybe it would have been kind of cool to see him maybe, you know, kick somebody in the head or something like that. Sort of have that as part of the film. Or at least, you know, maybe try to get him involved with a dance number. He was very athletic. I think, you know, he did a film around the same time as this, Skin Traffic, where he was the lead in it. And he played, you know, he was kind of showing that he still had it, that he's, you know, he still had the action chops to pull off a big film like that. So it does make me wonder if maybe, you know, he could have pulled off a dance routine. I would maybe like kind of a la Jean-Claude Van Damme, right? And
that is exactly what I was thinking, and exactly the actor that I was thinking of. I mean, it would have been delightful if you'd actually had you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme in this, busting out some of his kickboxer moves in here. Because I mean, you know, I wanted to see Gary Daniels dance. If you're going to put Gary Daniels in a musical, you've got to have him dance. I mean, I don't care, you know, you could just choreograph just at least 20 seconds of him busting a few shapes to just, you know, just give us a different side. I would have thought he would actually, you know, if he's taking these different films, you'd have thought he'd be saying, look, David, you know, give me a dance number to do here.
You know, I mean, what would have been great is with this whole idea of him, with him being like sort of, you know, stuffed shirt and very classist and all of those kinds of things. If he was the one, you know, if like maybe at the end of the film, he's the one going through that, you know, Latin American district in the city, and he's doing some of those Latin American moves. I mean, that would have been kind of fun to see him do that. But yeah, it's interesting. He does kind of get out of this. So like after The Wrong Child in 2016, he's kind of now doing more, you know, strictly, action films, it looks like. But there is always that sense, I think. I saw him in an interview with Scott Adkins, where Scott Adkins does this. I don't know if you know that series that he does on YouTube.
I think I've watched this interview. It's really good, actually.
Yeah, he was fantastic. He gave a lot of himself in there. And one of the things I think he talked about was that he really likes acting. Like, he wants to be good at being an actor. The other thing that's kind of funny is how he cringes at the thought of, like, The Secret of King Mahi's Island and those ones that we had, like, spent so long trying to find and wanting to watch of his. And he's just like, oh, I don't want anybody to even think of those movies. So it would be curious to know what he thinks of this movie, because it wasn't one that Scott Adkins brought up, unfortunately. But, you know, like, this one and also The Wrong Child, because I know he does say that, like, some of his that involve more acting than action, he's a little bit more fond of, so.
Okay, I think we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
When a hotshot federal prosecutor strikes a blow to the Colombian drug cartel, they strike back. Now, her life is in danger.
He's not going to let go until you're done.
Well, I know this case better than anyone.
The law won't protect her.
She's involved with a known gangster.
And the only one who can help her is a man on the inside.
So what do you want?
I want justice.
Yeah, well then go get it.
Backlash.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action, and it's rather an unusual one that we are witnessing here. It occurs during a short scene to establish Hal's tragic backstory. He's the sort of this mysterious old man who lives at the hotel as a bit of a recluse. We see him asleep in his hotel room. Next to him, there's a framed photograph of a young man dressed in military uniform who we presume is Hal's son. We then enter Hal's dream, and we briefly see an American Apache helicopter which explodes almost immediately, and from that we assume that is Hal's son dying. Matt, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action here?
Yeah, it felt like watching a bad commercial here in the U.S. for like a low budget one where they just edit things in to, you know, it's like call us now, and they edit in a picture of somebody holding a cell phone or something, like a stock film. The other thing too, I wonder, because David Pryor was involved with this and David Winters, I wonder how much they understood IMDb tagging. And I didn't check to see if this one had the exploding helicopter tag to it. It does make you wonder, like, you know, like if they throw these things in just in case, you know, it doesn't have the tag yet, but I mean, it could legitimately have the tag.
Well, I mean, it got me watching this film, which I wouldn't be watching otherwise. So I guess in that regard, you know, throwing that exploding helicopter, however brief, into the mix certainly, you know, served its purpose in getting another person to view this film. But this particular scene, this helicopter explodes very, very quickly. You know, the production values of the exploding helicopter are not very good. It looks like they've taken some footage from some much older film. There's a kind of grainy quality to it. It looks like it was shot on video in the 80s or something. But forgetting the sort of technical aspects of it, I actually think this exploding helicopter is really interesting because it takes place during Ken's famous angry dance. So this is this scene where after he's thwarted in his love affair with Jen, and he performs this solo routine soundtracked by a sort of new metal rock ballad, and he's he does most of this dance scene by a dumpster for reasons that are unexplained, and then throws a sun lounger into a swimming pool. But during Ken's angry dance, we then cut to Hal in his hotel room asleep, and basically it's the exploding helicopter in Hal's dream that wakes him up. And then because Hal wakes up, that's when he sort of comes out of his hotel room and sees Ken performing his angry dance. And if Hal doesn't see Ken at this particular moment, he doesn't become Ken's dance teacher. And what happened, you know, the rest of this film, all of the events that happen in the rest of the film don't happen. Ken doesn't win the dance contest. Perhaps he spends the next 40 years as a dishwasher in Gary Daniels' hotel. You know, perhaps Jen browbeaten into marrying Danny by Dad. And perhaps a grief-stricken Hal ends up just topping himself in his hotel room. I mean, it's if you think about what role the exploding helicopter plays in this film, in some ways it's actually the key plot moment of the entire movie.
You know, that's an excellent point, because a lot of times with these movies, right, the exploding helicopter is just sort of there to add a little action to the proceedings, but doesn't really further the plot in any way. But here, you're right. Like, I never really considered that piece of it, that it was, you know, the dream about the exploding helicopter. The interesting thing, too, about him having the dream about the exploding helicopter is that his son dies, in Iraq or Afghanistan. Hal would not have seen that happen, right? He wouldn't have known that there was an, you know, so it's fascinating that he knew that happened despite the fact that he was, I mean, I guess when you're having dreams, right, you sort of concoct things, you know, of any, so it's possible that he just thought he was, you know, in the dream he felt he was there. And yeah, and then of course, one of the great lines in the film comes, right, when Hal goes down to confront Ken about his dancing and says to him something along the lines of like, boy, you almost had it there if you hadn't thrown the patio furniture in the pool.
It all comes down to the exploding helicopter and the sun lounger. I think we've identified the two most significant plot points in this film. You know, there are a couple of other, you know, sort of interesting points in terms of the exploding helicopter I should point out. So this actually, I think, is the first film where we see an exploding helicopter take place within somebody's dream. I can't, in the 503 films that I've seen with an exploding helicopter, I can think of no other example where somebody dreams an exploding helicopter. The closest that we've come to it in another film is in the Steven Spielberg film Munich, where Eric Banner is having sex with his wife, and whilst he's on the job, so to speak, he has a flashback to an exploding helicopter that he saw whilst being in the middle of a commando raid. So that's the closest example that I can think. But at the moment, this is the only film to feature an exploding helicopter that takes place in someone's dream.
Yeah, in a way that makes sense, right? Because a lot of the times the way that the helicopter comes in, it's you know, I mean, when you look at like all the ones that you've posted on Twitter, which I think are fantastic. That's always like always kind of a fun part of the day to go through the Twitter feed and see which one you've posted. You know, you think of films like you know, General Commander with Steven Seagal, where somebody just happens to have a rocket launcher nearby, or I think it was Cage 2 that you posted recently, where somebody just happened to have a rocket launcher in their trunk and they take out a helicopter that's flying in the area that's attacking them. So yeah, you almost never see it in a dream because it's supposed to be part of the action that's happening there. So it's sort of a way to tack it on to what's going on there.
And just in terms of Gary Daniels, I know as you're a big fan of Mr. Daniels, I just thought, you know, this is yet another film that he's been in with an exploding helicopter. And he's currently joint second as the actor who's appeared in the most films with an exploding helicopter. He's been in nine of them, which puts him two behind another favourite actor of yours, Dolph Lundgren. So always good to see, you know, Gary Daniels, you know, in a film with an exploding helicopter, I imagine, Matt.
Yes, that, is he tied with Don the Dragon? Is that who has nine?
He's tied with Donald Pleasance.
Oh, God, that's right. Oh, I think I heard that in another one of your or maybe, where, how did I know about the Donald Pleasance one? I feel like that came up somewhere recently.
But yeah, so I mean, he's I've still got some of his films to watch. So you know, it's possible that he could move up in the rankings, and obviously he's still out there making movies. So it's still an opportunity for him to move up our rankings and steal the top spot. But you know, Matt, I think probably now's a good a time as any to wrap things up for this show. So you know, thanks for joining me once again. I mean, this is your fourth appearance on Exploding Helicopter, and I know over on your site you like to put actors in different clubs depending on the number of films that you've reviewed of theirs. So as of now, you're in the four club, and I thought I'd have a look at on your website who else has been tagged four times on your site. So you're now in the four club along with Billy Zane, Treat Williams, and Bruce Campbell.
Wow. I mean, I don't know if I have the eyebrows to match Billy Zane, but definitely it's nice to know that I'm in that category. Treat Williams, I think there's some people out there that would be upset that I'm tied with Treat. They'd want more Treat on our site, so there's that. But I Billy Zane, I feel, is a very honor because he made Titanic for me. I just love his character in Titanic. I love when he's holding the baby or the young girl at the end, and he's like, "She's all I've got," so he can get on the raft. And yeah, he just that movie wouldn't have really worked for me if it wasn't for Billy Zane. So.
Well, congratulations on your membership of the Exploding Helicopter 4 Club. Do you want to tell people what you've got going on at the moment and where they can find you online?
Yeah, so my new novel is out now, A Girl and a Gun. It's available on Amazon, both on Kindle or paperback. And with Kindle, you don't necessarily need to have an actual Kindle device. You can download the app for your smartphone or tablet. And so then that's available there. My previous novel, Chad and Accounting, is also available on there. The website is dtvconnoisseur.blogspot.com. That has links to everything. So that has links to where you can get the books, has links to social media like Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And then, of course, the podcast on iTunes. I think it's iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify is where it's available right now. But that I'm trying to get it out once a month. We'll see. My most recent one had was talking with Sean Molloy from I Must Kill This Podcast or Must Break This Podcast, that Dolph one about Bruce Willis's film Precious Cargo and kind of the Bruce Willis phenomenon with these. Sort of, which again, complete opposite of this movie. This movie was made in all earnestness and that kind of was more refreshing in that sense.
Oh, definitely. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website, explodinghelicopter.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or Letterboxd. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
You blew it, kid. What are you talking about? Blew what? The dance number. You were looking great till you threw the chair in the pool. That's when you blew it.
What do you know about dancing? You don't know anything about dancing.
What do I know about dancing?
Yeah, that's right. What do you know, huh? Dancing is my life. You don't know a single thing about dancing.
Oh, no? Where'd you learn that?
Forget you ever saw it, kid. Just forget you ever saw that.